It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Okay, we are joined here today, which I think is our first podcast with a band. We've done interviews with bands before, but we did kind of an audio documentary on the Black Flags Over Brooklyn festival. We had somebody from It's Going Down go there, and I'm lucky enough to sit down with one of the bands that played there. Just to dive into it, do people want to introduce the band and just tell us a little bit of history when it started?
Sure. My name is Money. I sing for Race Trader, and we got Brent online, who Brent plays bass, and Andy, who plays drums. We started in the early mid-90s, I should say, 1996 approximately, and we were sort of played the punk hardcore scene back then, and we broke up not too long later in 99, and we just kind of became active again in 2016.
So y'all just got back from playing Black Flags Over Brooklyn. You know, we were really like pumped about this because like the person that went out there even like read a bunch of books on black metal and like just like read all the stuff on extreme music to kind of like get prepared. So we were like, what is this corpse paint? And trying to like figure all this out. I'm just curious, you know, how did it go? Did you enjoy it? And what were your big takeaways from the festival itself?
Yeah, it was amazing. It was really inspiring and heartening that, you know, such an amazing festival came together and went off without a hitch. And it feels like everyone there really had a great time and felt good about it and safe and like, you know, kind of did the job of hopefully carving out, you know, a space for specifically anti-fascist, anti-racist, anti-capitalist, anti-colonial, anti-settler colonial music, you know, especially in like extreme metal or whatever, which, you know, I think historically does kind of favor more right-wing reactionary types. And it's a really important thing to have kind of, you know, revolutionary culture in music have, you know, a bigger stage to hopefully keep building it, you know, to be a part of the bigger conversation. And it was cool that there was one in Portland too that seems to have gone well that I didn't even know about until I got home and whatever.
I mean, for us, it was like really amazing to be around bands that take really principled and clear stances on, you know, radical racial justice platform, a radical class justice, anti-sexism, anti-homophobia sort of platform, and are vocal about it, and they wear it on their sleeves. We play a lot of shows where we're the only band like that. Sort of be in an environment where it's just like all your, I guess, colleagues, and they're all, you know, they're all like flying their radical freak flag very proudly. It was like really kind of an amazing and heartening experience. And for us, we see it sort of as ground zero of what should be a larger movement that spreads from there.
In today's age, do you believe it is an achievable goal to create an anti-fascist and anti-racist and anti-sexist space within extreme music scenes?
I mean, if you look at the history of the hardcore scene, and if you look at sort of the what we call the Antifa movement and organizations like Anti-Racist Action, that was born in the Anti-Racist Action and that whole thing kind of came out of the hardcore scene. And it's because in the 80s and early 90s, neo-Nazi groups had particularly targeted this room of, you know, these rooms of angry white men mostly, right? I mean, hardcore and metal are mostly angry white men, and that is the target audience of the Nazis, whether they're the whatever brand of Nazi you want to call it. But that's the target audience. So in the 80s and all the way through the 90s, depending on which town you were in, it could last all the way to like 99, people were fighting the fascists out of the scene. And they mostly did so pretty successfully in hardcore. But in metal, it was never quite as, there was never quite such an explicit movement. And I think part of that came down to, there's always been like racism in metal. There's always been left-wing bands like Napalm Death, and there's always been like right-wing bands. And, but the right-wing stuff wasn't as articulated clearly as a movement and as an ideology, in my opinion. Some people might differ to this, until the black metal scene. So the black metal scene took what was like typical right-wing crypto-fascist, crypto-Nazi, like hick white power stuff, but then gave it this sense that it's part of a cultural, religious identity movement. And I think that gave it like a different twist, and that made it something kind of, not that it wasn't dangerous before, but it made it something even more dangerous or more worthy of confronting. And because it was so front and center that these bands all kind of, you know, have this sort of racist fetishization of European culture, it helped normalize it a lot. You know, metalheads have this sort of like kind of fuck it attitude, like whatever, man, like, oh, that's the crazy thing that so-and-so believes. And they don't really kind of always think about the larger ramifications of normalizing really violent, you know, ethnic cleansing rooting ideologies. And so I guess for us, the reason the fest was really important is that, you know, these spaces that we go to, these shows that we go to, we should at least make sure we're kind of exemplifying our broader political ideals in those spaces as much as possible. And in our utopian vision, there's going to be dissenting opinions and people are going to disagree on things, but there's no room for fascists and there's no room for people who call for ethnic cleansing. So let's at least get them out of the scene. And at least let's confront them by saying, oh, you guys think you have a movement and an ideology. Well, we have one that's like stronger and more compelling because it unifies people on a much greater level and it challenges real power. You know, these white power people, they're totally in line with, they're totally in line with the system they claim to rebel against. I mean, white Europeans being racist is the most boring cliche thing ever.
Right.
Like,
or support the president.
And not obvious at all.
Yeah, it's the most, like, it's the default. You know, you're just, you have the same political ideology as your grandfather. So, like, what is so radical and cool about that? But they get to put on, but they put on corpse paint and they sing songs to Odin and, you know, all of a sudden it becomes interesting to, you know, a bunch of other sort of disaffected, angry white men that get to feel victimized. But then instead of feeling like victims, they feel like they're part of the legacy of Thor. And, you know, it's it seems really empowering. So for us, that fest was just sort of about, it was about that space, but it was about, this is the space we control. Let's make this an anti-fascist space. And use that anti-fascist space as a platform for them going and being part of actual community movements to overthrow fascism worldwide. Like, our goal is not to make black flags out of black flags over Brooklyn an anti-fascist space. Our goal is not to make the metal scene an anti-fascist space or the hardcore punk scene. Our goal is to make the world anti-fascist. Mm-hmm. But this is where we have a little bit of control. This is where we could put our thumb on the scale. It's a good starting point, and let's go from there.
The one other thing I would add to that very long answer, which I agree with completely, is there has been some things starting to be written out about kind of this new wave of anti-fascist metal. And so a couple like kind of media outlets have kind of articulated that, and that kind of feels right to me. In the last year or so, I think we've connected with a lot of other bands that either are from metal or punk or in between grind, that like, you know, are much more vocal, like Money is kind of articulating on their stances. And so it's, I think something is kind of happening. And like the fest itself, I mean, I've never given so many just like high fives and like hugs to people. You know what I mean? It was just a very like cool space to be in where everyone was very much aligned and very much supportive of each other. And so, I mean, I'm stoked. And I think there is something, there has been something kind of happening, which is great.
Do you think that this kind of growing of space could be expanded to other genres of music, for instance, like hip hop?
I'll start, but I'd also want to hear Andy's answer on this, too, because Andy lives in the world of music more than anybody else. So, I mean, look, I think that art can push society, but it's also kind of comes alongside society, like social movements. So every social movement has been influenced by art, but every social movement also brings art into it. So music is a huge part of people's lives. I mean, it motivates them. It makes them feel connected to others who share the same tastes. And music has always had, music and politics have always sort of combined. So we're living in a time now where there are very clear lines being drawn about which side you stand on. Like, what is your view of how society should be formed? What are your view of the hierarchies that should be exist in society? And I think it's natural for artists to decide which side of that line they stand on and to mobilize around it and to create art that reflects it. We always have everybody in this band, the reason we do this band is because we were inspired by other musicians and visual artists and novelists that infused their art with politics, right? So I don't think this band would exist in the same way if we hadn't grown up listening to, you know, political hip hop like Public Enemy or rock bands like Rage Against the Machine or punk bands like Propaganda. Like, all of those things informed who we were, and we consider ourselves part of that, a continuation of that sort of legacy. And so to your question specific, I think it's natural for music to get more politicized as society gets more politicized. And the battle is right now is that, you know, corporate institutions and corporate culture, whether it be, you know, media outlets or Facebook or whatever it is, they're trying to keep things superficial. They're trying to make sure that we stay, you know, sort of isolated, and we consume like music as just something to keep us pacified. But I think that's not an answer that most people can live with in an age where things are so polarized and what is right and wrong is so clear to people. So I think we are going to see a resurgence of political music and political scenes everywhere. Just like, you know, all things that were 90s are getting popular again, people have to remember, like, 90s hip hop was extremely radical and extremely political. Mm-hmm. 90s punk was extremely radical and extremely political. And I think that thing is going to happen again, because it's very clear to people that it's sort of a different era, and you have to produce art that reflects your era.
Yeah, I'll jump in, I guess. I mean, I agree with Money on everything he said, especially with hip hop, that I think, you know, obviously has been politicized from the beginning and is a very political art form, and I don't feel qualified to speak on it. But, you know, I think a lot of cool stuff's coming out now, like soul is very specifically, you know, an anarchist and into really cool shit. Bobby Sessions, Vic Mensa, you know, are all saying good stuff.
I mean, Kendrick is the biggest thing in hip hop.
Yeah, Kendrick, right. Of course.
Right.
I mean, maybe a specific like show, like anti-fascist kind of show. I don't know, but I do think it'll spread. Like Money said, I think it's the fear I have, I guess, is that capitalism and neoliberalism so insidious at co-opting and, you know, kind of neutering the strength of any movement in it, and you know, the specificity of something and turning it into kind of a Hallmark card or something. So that's why I think stuff like Black Flags is really important because it's so specific and purposeful. But yeah, I just see a lot of good things happening right now. And like Money said, I think music can drive culture, but definitely is oftentimes just very reflective of it and will continue to be.
As you were saying before, I mean, you've been a band now for over 20 years. You started in the 90s, took a break, and then came back. When you first started, what was the political climate like dealing with overt and covert racism, both in the scene and the country at large, and how would you compare that to today?
I think the band was, the band formed in 96, and I think we were in so many ways a response to Clintonism. And like, so Clinton... I mean, Clinton campaigned as a racist anti-racist, you know, like he had his Sister Soldier moment where he took a political black militant woman and just humiliated her in front of the country to gain votes from white people. He, you know, positioned himself as tough on crime, but then he went to like black churches and cried. And, you know, and then he passed the most draconian crime bill that like, exploded mass incarceration on a level you've never seen before. He passed a draconian immigration bill that really stunted the ability of families to come to the United States from around the world and start a new life. And he passed the anti-terrorism bill, which is it's just basically the forefather of the Patriot Act that really allowed not only radical communities, but, you know, all sorts of communities to be infiltrated and, you know, picked apart. So we were living in that era where a guy who claimed to, you know, march with King and stuff was basically running this like white power project. And I think we were reacting to that. So what was different about then is, we were actually telling people, like, don't pay too much attention to the boneheads and the Klan and the skinheads and the neo-Nazis, because it's the institutions that are really doing the damage. Those other things that were much weaker back then, right? The sort of self-labeled white power movement was much weaker, but the covert white power movement that had all the power because there was, you know, they had the corporate money, they had the political power, they had the White House and the Congress and the Senate. That stuff was doing some real damage to poor black and brown communities, to immigrant communities. And we were really, really, I think, reacting to that. And so we really focused on explaining what institutional racism was to people. It's that phrase, institutional racism, is really common now. And I think most people understand what it is. But back then it was like when punk rockers talked about racism, they talked about tolerance versus intolerance. And we were talking about power versus, you know, lack of power. And it's a difference, and it's a really important distinction. Like, if the black community had power to shape their economy, ensure their unemployment, ensure their health standards for the community, to mitigate police violence, no amount of intolerance from the white community in the world would be able to penetrate it, right? But the Black community in the United States has been historically, intentionally out of power, disenfranchised, kept away from power, beyond, you know, moments of tokenism or beyond moments of power that they earn through struggle and resistance. And so we wanted to really make that clear. So that's what was really going on in the 90s. Now, people know what institutional racism means. People know what white privilege means. People understand that white power isn't necessarily just flying, you know, having a swastika tattoo, that white power looks like a guy in a suit and tie that's, you know, showing you a spreadsheet. And so for now, for us, the conversation is really about pushing people to say, okay, you have this analysis. A lot of you have sophisticated analysis, or if this is sophisticated analysis is sort of at your fingertips through the internet and all the media outlets you consume. So now let's talk about organizing. Now let's talk about how we take our skills and add it to a movement to sort of dismantle these institutions.
And I think also the kind of thing that's the same is we were also, I mean, just because of some of our personal histories and some of it, you know, myself was involved in a lot of solidarity work in the 80s and 90s in Central America. You know, we were just getting out of these almost these genocidal civil wars then, right? And it was kind of this moment of how the region was going to kind of rebuild itself. And I think a lot of what we talked about was kind of U.S. power in the region was really pushing it to a total disaster. And in the past 20 years, we've seen this. I mean, we've seen what's happened in Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Mexico. And it's really a direct result of a lot of U.S. policy and power in the region. And so I think, you know, right now, you know, a lot of us are still involved in that work. But, you know, you think about like the caravan, you think about this thing about MS-13 and all these kind of things, which are a direct result of U.S. interventionalism in the region. And so I think we're almost like, unfortunately, continuing that conversation as things have worked out in basically the most horrific vision any of us had for that situation. And so I think that's a big also part of it. And it's very, I think, sad and disheartening that that is kind of the way things went. But it's not, again, too surprising given kind of what was going on post-Civil War in Guatemala, El Salvador, and then its connections to Honduras. So.
And I think what's different is being abandoned under Trump versus abandoned under Clinton is that
right.
Trump exemplifies all those things. It's like unambiguous. He admits to it. He basically says openly, I'm a racist and an imperialist, and I believe in violence as the number one instrument. You know, like all of that stuff is clear with Trump, you know, and he's not sophisticated enough or not willing, or maybe he is sophisticated to know that that sells. But the point is, like, he doesn't have much, you know, softening up in terms of PR. Whereas with Clinton, you know, it was amazing. I mean, people loved him. People thought he was like this amazing progressive and, you know, the future of race relations and workers' rights and environmentalism and all that stuff. So it's much easier for us as a band to get people on board using Trump as our foil versus Clinton as our foil. And of course, we appreciate that in some ways, not that we appreciate Trump, but we appreciate that people are so clear on what's wrong about this government. But our fear would also be that people think that if Trump is swapped out, that the threat has gone away and we've
Right, that like Cory Booker is the answer or something.
You know exactly. I mean, that's not our position at all. And actually, the one good thing, like Cory Booker and Bill Clinton are perfect examples of this, because the one thing that sort of happened in the 90s is this move to change activism and make it a product of like capitalism. So you have, you know, especially, I mean, you really have seen this like balloon in the last couple years, but it's always, you know, this idea of like corporate, you know, private public partnerships, right? So it's this idea that actually it's the private sector, it's the capitalist sector that's going to solve global warming. It's not that they caused it, not that they have worked to, you right, know, no maintain carbon emissions, but they're going to solve
space offices that you can write on the wall and like work share. I mean, it's just, it's fucking crazy. But yeah.
Right.
just to interject, Manny, I think you brought this up before in another interview I listened to, just this kind of terrain where a lot of people in the mass media like take on this air of wokeness. And I'm just curious, so what does that mean to somebody that is talking about white supremacy as this structural force that organizes society in a real radical way?
I mean, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people in the media. I mean, this is the whole problem with the debate about representation. We're 100% about representation. Like, I'm all about giving, you know, handing over power to Black women and, you know, Latino women. I think they do a much better job on average, right? Because you look at where their politics are, you look at where the experiences that they've accumulated, they're going to do a better job. But there's this whole thing now, and the media pushes it, is the most shallow, baseless definition of what representation means. It's not representation of the community. It's representation of like a tone, like a skin color. And it's a real problem. And if I was a Black person in the United States, I would vote for every single Black candidate because at least they look like me, right? Because you, if you have no trust that the system is going to provide for you, then at least you could have trust that the system would like have you be in a visually at least in a position of power. There's a total rationale to it. I mean, like when Bernie Sanders said that thing before that makes it seem like identity politics is irrational, that's total bullshit. There's a total rationale to it. If the system has screwed you over and over and over, at least, you know, you could have a symbolic victory, because symbolic victories do translate into like, you know, people's psychological state. It might not translate into bread and butter, you know, how much food can you put on the kitchen table, but you're getting screwed on that anyway. You're getting screwed on that anyway. So who cares? So I'm not railing against that. I'm never going to tell somebody that they shouldn't vote for somebody that that feels like it represents their community. But the media pushes for, they find the most shallow versions of these community representatives and they just catapult them. And it's a real problem. And I think it's, you know, and I think one of the roles that like non-white people can play, right, is like there's a lot of attack in like sort of socialist circles on identity politics. It's super fucked up because it just comes across that you're just attacking Black and brown people and queer people for wanting people who at least visually or somehow represent their community from being in power. It looks really, really bad and it's really counterproductive. What needs to happen, in my opinion, is that communities, these like sort of white activist communities, need to start supporting in any way they can, like grassroots, community-based, Black, brown, working class organizations to be in a position where they can start putting forth their own candidates, where they can be in a position to start articulating their own shit, as opposed to just like attacking, you know, people for wanting a Black president that's still a neoliberal when everybody's just voting for neoliberals anyway. I mean, what is anybody doing? I think the real trick is that we have the way to counter the media is through putting your weight behind the exact thing the media is trying to hide. And what the media is trying to hide is, you know, these community-based Black and brown organizations and leaderships that have been really fighting the good fight for years with little to no exposure. And I think our responsibility is to try to platform these people and give them as much exposure and power as possible.
Moving on to more of a music question. You all have been described as a mix of metal and punk or metalcore. I've heard this term being used on this album. Do you see yourselves as part of like the punk scene, straight edge, hardcore, metal? Is it all of the above or none? Is there like a musical flag you feel more an affinity with, or is it kind of a mixture, or is it just your own brand?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really care too much for like genrefying it. I guess we all came up in like the hardcore scene, and you know, one point we're all straight edge and most of us are vegan and all important stuff to us coming up. But I don't know. I feel like we're somewhere in the nexus of metal and punk and hardcore.
We're basically two too metal for punk and too punk for metal, I think is probably exactly the genre we're in.
Cool.
I would agree with that.
I'm not sure what the genre was, but the Black Flags Over Brooklyn seemed like our genre.
Yeah, that was our genre.
You know, I mean, none of those bands sounded like, or some of us did, but that felt like our genre.
Almost seeing like people that got started in punk and hardcore then like ended up playing metal at some point in their lives, which is really, it's interesting.
I mean, that's that's what we all, I mean, with the exception of me, everybody in the band, I mean, grew up, like we're in junior high school, we're listening to metal. They're all, everybody in the band was listening to Metallica and Slayer. Then they somehow found hardcore through that. And then they just decided, actually, we like metal. So that's basically like, in terms of like the musical trajectory, I think that's the musical trajectory of our band. So we started in the hardcore scene. We started playing to, we always thought of hardcore as an attitude, as a principle, as opposed to a sound. And then we started off kind of like, you know, noisy, power violence-y hardcore band. And then we just decided everybody in the band just likes extreme metal and death metal in particular. And that's basically what we started playing. And Black Flags kind of returns to that idea that our genre is more about spirit and attitude than it is about the riffs. Sonically, we're a metal band. I mean, the riffs are firmly within the canon of metal. But spiritually, I don't know. We're Black Flags Over Brooklyn.
Awesome. Continuing on with the line of political punk rock, you know, when a lot of people think about that, they think of kind of like crass bands or groups like the Dead Kennedys from the United States. And I think while these groups were really great, you know, most of the big names of American political bands at least tended to shy away, it seems, from talking about race or white supremacy specifically. And I was curious if there were bands that influenced you all when launching Race Trader that talked about race and why understanding it, especially in the so-called Americas, was so important to understanding our context.
I'll take it, I guess. I think in the hardcore scene, there was a lot of bands that were kind of confronting these things head on in different ways, like whether it be Groundwork or Struggle or Ire, stuff like that, that kind of came up around the same time that maybe a little prior to us being around, but anyone else?
I mean, Los Crudos was a big influence on us because we are from Chicago.
The other bands, to jump in, I mean, I think Chicago was very different because it was a very political scene. And, you know, obviously everyone knows about Los Crudos and there. But there was also this band called Billingsgate that's from, like, the same town as we are, just north of Chicago, that I think, like, if you, you know, and Big Frank put their record out, you know, and Nemesis Records, I mean, it's called No Apologies. But if you really read the lyrics, I mean, they're talking about, you know, U.S. Invading Chile and all these things and racism. I mean, they were really, to me, was the main, I think, influence on us. And there was this band called Bloodline from Minneapolis that I think were very similar. I think both of them were bands that were like super smart, you know what I mean? And could articulate things and could put them into lyrics in a way that I think was, like really profound on us. And then I think too, Earth Crisis, you know, I think also had a huge influence on all of us, particularly around veganism. And I think they started to talk a little bit about some of the issues, and we didn't always agree with everything, but I feel like they were a band that had a big influence on us as well.
And I don't want to like discount, I think I already mentioned this, but like all of us were really influenced politically by 90s hip hop.
Yeah. And Public Enemy, for
sure. Public Enemy,
Arrested Development,
like KRS-One,
BDP, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Almost every record we've ever put out, there's some reference to 90s hip hop in there because it's, I mean, it's like a conscious thing. It started out unconsciously, and then we decided to just make it a conscious thing and continue the tradition. But there's always like some sort of homage to 90s hip hop, whether it's a lyric or whether it's a, you know, a song title or a quote. And it's because like that was like hugely influential on us. And that I think had a big role in like our specific focus on race and racial justice and black liberation.
Mm-hmm. Also put, I don't know about you all, but I would put Tupac in there, another great artist that was very critical of, Clinton's policies.
For sure.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I once a day I say, keep your head up to myself. So.
Just as a nerdy musical aside, you know, we're doing a series of interviews with people about the 90s, about different social movements and different things like that. I'm curious, like, did you all have a connection to, like, the growing, like, anarcho, like, crust scene, like, specifically, like, bands that were on, like, Tribal War Records? Like, you know, like, a huge band for me was Ossrotten in the 90s. Were you all, like, kind of watching that scene, or was there any interaction with that? Because I think it's really interesting that you had this, like, super political hardcore scene, and then there was super political, like, anarcho, like, crust scene, and there was, like, seems like a lot of similarities, but also some divergence, either musically or, you know, obviously, one group liked to drink and one group didn't, I think.
There was kind of a scene in the 90s that was, like, centered around, it was, I kind of call it, like, maybe a post-Born Again scene. It was centered around Ebullition Records. Mm-hmm. And it was basically a crustier version of the straight edge scene. So it was basically trying to do the best of both of those worlds. And we listened to some of the crust bands, the political crust bands, and we really liked them. Like, I think His Hero's Gone, for example, is a big influence on Race Traitor in some ways, mm-hmm. at least in terms of like the feeling of what it means to be heavy and driving. But I think we were sort of really, I think we came up in that kind of abolition-y, like post-Born Again scene that's something in between, right? It's not quite that like classic straight edge hardcore scene, and it's not quite the full on, you know, anarcho punk scene. It has a little bit of both. And I think that that's kind of shaped what we sort of did. And what we are aesthetic, and it shaped a lot of things. We were also influenced by Riot Grrrl, which was another big musical, cultural, political movement in the 90s. Kind of right around when we started the band, we were really close to a group of Riot Grrrls that had moved from the Pacific Northwest to Chicago. And so some of the ways they were sort of like, they did kind of confrontational, in-your-face messaging around feminism influenced some of our sort of confrontational in-your-face messaging around race and class. So that was something we were actually closer to than the traditional anarcho-punk movement, and that sort of informed what we did.
What period was that when they moved from the Pacific Northwest to Chicago? I'm curious.
I would say we met those people around 94, 95. And then we started Race Traitor in 96. Hmm. So we were always kind of into that whole, you know, like Riot Grrrl was always a really interesting thing to us. We were an all male band. So it wasn't like something that we were necessarily, it wasn't the center of what we did, not just because we were all males, but we were just sort of involved in the sort of, like I said, crustier straight edge scene. But when we met those people, it became, I don't know, they sort of challenged us to think a little bit deeper, you know, this kind of political, like more, I guess with the, you know, I guess what people would now call critical theory. Mm-hmm. In some ways was introduced to us through Riot Grrrl, because Riot Grrrl was the punkification of critical theory. And that kind of helped us. We kind of applied that stuff to what we were doing in terms of race and class.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And like you said, I think most people, they think of the Pacific Northwest when they think of that scene, and it'd be really, I think there's a lot of books written about it, but I'm curious to learn more about just all the other bands that were across the U.S. and beyond.
And there was this like fanzine called Positron, which was a queer straight edge fanzine. And I remember like its analytical approach to what it meant to be not be homophobic, or what it meant, what a queer friendly space meant, was like mind blowing. And I think it was like, that was another thing that it was just like really kind of changed my perception of what politics meant. And that was one of the things that kind of moved me away from like a really shallow analysis of politics and started thinking about like, you know, like deeper meanings to how culture and institutions kind of exert power.
You all took a break and then reformed after Trump was voted into office. And I know a lot of people were rubbing their hands together, expecting that with Trump in office, we were going to have an explosion of awesome bands, political songs, great film, graffiti, comedy, everything that kind of spoke to the political situation. I'm just curious now, 3 years into Trump's presidency, are you excited and happy with what's happened that's come out artistically, or are you more or less underwhelmed?
I think it's been really good so far. Like I said, I just came into discovering Bobby Sessions recently, which seems like it's kind of a response to a lot of things that have been happening in the last bunch of years. You know, Vic Mensa kind of being more and more politicized. He had a really good interview on Intercepted talking about Palestine and kind of some of the parallels with, you know, the struggle of people of color in the U.S. And then I think hardcore seems to have become a little more politicized in the wake of Trump being elected. I know for me personally, I feel like I kind of got a little lazy in my politics and my critique and my analysis of things. And it definitely, you know, when that was happening and we decided to get the band back together to respond to it, because it felt really important and like the right time to do it, it definitely kind of brought me back fully to, you know, thinking about things a lot again and figuring out ways to, you know, take it beyond just doing a band, but, you know, doing other things that I can, you know, personally.
I would agree with Andy. I mean, well, I had a weird moment in hardcore and punk actually with the Bush administration. So I thought it was going to be like the 80s then. Do you know what I mean? Just because Bush is like a total lunatic. You know what I mean? And I remember going to hardcore and punk shows and being like, you know, we're supposed to be like against this. You know what I mean? It was this weird interaction where I found myself being like, you know what? I'm just gonna go watch the Dixie Chicks because the only one's like taking a stand right now. You know what I mean? Like during the Bush administration. And so it was weird. And so I really felt like disheartened by like music and stuff during the Bush administration. And I think, you know, Obama obviously was a complicated time for people, but I mean, still his policies were as, you know, as bad as ever. And I think, though, in Trump, I do feel like Andy's saying, there has been more of a response and you can just kind of feel it. And it seems like, you know, in Chicago, there's a lot of like, you know, local hardcore bands that like from the outside don't like have political names or have songs like maybe written about that. But when they play some of these like smaller, you know, real DIY shows, like it's in the room, it's in the conversation, whether it be about immigration or whatever. And so I think to me, it's been like very exciting and very inspiring. And I think like well overdue, you know?
Cool. And you all have a Trump Tower in the middle of your downtown, I believe.
Yeah, I can kind of see it right now.
Sword to the game, we bound ourselves. in the drones. We've got ourselves in the balls as perfect gods for the system.
Servants, get off your knees. Slaves, take a fucking knife to the throats of your oppressors. We forge these chains, link by link, and shroud our lives in suffering, negating any attempt to change.
Live with the shadows of fate. Of a world was full of beauty. Now blackened skies with tears of poison. The lines of expression of this false sense of necessity pass down to generations of ignorance.
So in an interview I just referenced, you said, we have always believed that punk and hardcore are above all acts of culture resistance. And just, I'm just curious if you see that that format is having changed in any major way since the 1990s. Or has the increase, because I mean, the big change, obviously, I mean, there's been lots of changes since the 90s, but, you know, a huge change in terms of music and how people like find music, of course, have been the internet. Do you think that this increase in like technological alienation or people just spending so much time on their screens has made DIY spaces and music scenes more meaningful or less?
I think it's made it more meaningful because I do see that being a real problem and kind of rekindling these personal human connections with each other is really important. And I think, you know, that's the thing from punk and hardcore that really changed my life and affected me is, you know, meeting all these people who have similar, you know, views and perspectives. And I think it is a really important thing right now when it is so easy to get lost in technology and social networking and whatever.
I think a lot of people who are involved in these scenes, it's really important to them. Like, it's extremely, it becomes like really a place that becomes like their home. You know, some people have church, some people have their bowling league, some people have, you know, different ways that they, you know, connect with people in a ritualistic manner. And if you're in an underground scene, it's through going to these shows and listening to this music. So it becomes really important that you have a form of that that doesn't contribute to the isolation, right? So it's not like, okay, we're not just conversing online. We actually have human touch and emotion and we can see each other, but it can't be like super trapped in the room either. So there's the flip side to it. So I think like it's really important for people to have a place to go and a place to be themselves. And I think it's really important that place that they go and place that be themselves makes them a more effective, I don't know what's for, I guess it's a cheesy term, but makes them like a more effective global citizen, right? Like, I don't know something cooler to say than global citizen. If you guys can think of something that doesn't sound, yeah, because that totally sounds like, you know, Bill Clinton would talk about, you know,
right. We know what you're saying.
Inside a climax money.
You know what we're saying. Human being, like that's what a human being is supposed to be, right? So, yeah, I mean, I think that that's like something that is, that's why I think we stay part of scenes. Like, I mean, by we, I mean the members of this band. We all have like lives that involve music and activism that are on arguably a bigger scale than what we're doing here. But we feel like, okay, with these people though, we can make like really personal connections and that can translate into something in their lives that can translate something into something much bigger socially. So yeah, I mean, isolation it's a trick. We're designed to isolate ourselves. I mean, that's what white supremacy is about. It's about, you know, carving society up into, you know, the in club and the out club. And then if you just keep carving it, then we all just become really easy to manipulate.
I mean, I think what's been interesting in Chicago, at least in the hardcore scene, is like, you know, before like different protests and different stuff, you wouldn't see a lot of hardcore kids, as we call them, at these things. And I remember, like a month or two ago, being at one and just seeing like a lot of like hardcore punks there and like us all kind of like marching together, even though we didn't know each other. You know what I mean? It was just like, everyone could just tell like that, you know, that was part of their culture. And it was like really cool. You know what I mean? Like it felt like, how it was a bit in the 90s. You know what I mean? That we were all be at a show, but then we'd see each other at like a protest or whatever. You know what I mean? Or at a community center or doing stuff. And so I feel that a lot more, and I see a lot more like just kind of, at least in some of the activist scenes that I'm involved in, like there is a kind of a punk hardcore contingency, which makes me very happy.
So the title of the new album is 2042, which supposedly represents the year in which white people cease from becoming the supermajority in the United States to becoming the largest racial grouping within the United States. Is that correct?
That's what the statistics show.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Just check.
Yes. That's okay. That's what the title is a reference to. Yes.
I just think it's funny too, because it's like we're still going to be the largest block, but we're scared that the other blocks could come together and potentially be larger than us. But
right. The secret is that the other blocks, as somebody who is arguably a member of one of the other blocks. Mm-hmm. I can tell you the secret is not all the other blocks like each other either. So there's a lot. It's really a falsified fear, but
right. And that fear has always been part of the American system. I mean, like, you know, we use all these slaves to amass all this wealth, but yet we're terrified of the fact that there's millions of people. And I'm just curious, you know, as we head towards, you know, 2042, looking at everything that comes out of Trump and people like Tucker Carlson's mouth that really are, you know, amassing lots of power off of this fear. I mean, you can, you know, watch Tucker Carlson. I mean, that's literally like his baseline. You know, what trends do you see continuing?
The fear of 2042 and whatever the reality of 2042 is going to be is like really fueling so much of this. Like the way our band sees it is this. You had the Iraq War and you had the 2008 financial collapse. And I think those things showed the emperor had no clothes. Like neoliberals, U.S. hegemony, military imperialism, all that stuff failed miserably in those two moments in a way that, you know, the simplest analysis would conclude. And they've been doing everything in their power since, by they, I mean, like sort of the corporate and political elite have been doing everything in their power since to show you actually, no, you know, we can get the trains running back on time again, and it's no big deal. But a large number of people felt that pain, and they felt what it means, and not just in the U.S., around the world. And the people who best stepped into that space are the fascists. So the fascists had a very simple narrative, which is, yes, all of those failures are because we've given up these sort of core ideals of who we are as a nation. And what are we as a nation? We're a white, Christian, you know, traditional nation. And, you know, that's, and the solution is to sort of go back to that, is to make America great again, right? Is to reclaim European identity, is what they say in Germany, right? It's everywhere, it's something different. It has a slightly different brand, but it's the same thing, which is allow these authoritarians to come in and correct the failures of neoliberalism by bringing you something even more racist and more draconian and more exploitative. And the left hasn't really stepped into that space as effectively, but it has to some extent. So, I mean, if you look at the quote unquote millennials, I mean, this is a very progressive generation. And they're starting to mobilize in real ways. We saw that with Occupy. We saw that with Black Lives Matter. We saw that to some extent with the people who got behind Bernie Sanders. And it's going to only continue, I think, down that path. And so we have a sort of narrative and counter-narrative around really like 2042, which is like this. Another way to look at 2042 is to look at it as an era where certain demographics, whether that be, brown and black people and, you know, principled white allies and, you know, white working class that aren't seduced by the mythology of white supremacy, those people have a moment where they have numbers. They have numbers that can compete with those traditional numbers that the, you know, that the racist institutions and the fascists have always tried to mobilize. And that's what's coming to a head. So Trump and Trumpism, they really understand this. I mean, their entire immigration project is about slowing down the browning of America because they need to reposition themselves to have power should that conflict come about. And they are selling that unambiguously to white Americans, a lot of whom are buying into it. Yes, we're scared of the browning of America because it means the political disenfranchisement. If you're a poor white person, you know, living in one of these like sort of Rust Belt towns.
Like Chicago,
right? You've lost almost all the privileges of whiteness, but you're still white. And you don't want that being white to no longer be a privilege. So it gets messaged to you, oh, your culture is being changed by all these Latinos. And, you know, they're going to be running amok and they're bringing crime and they're bringing drugs and they're the ones corrupting your society. And it's really easy to go for it, right? Unless we treat white supremacy as a cult, which it is, and we, you know, we challenge the brainwashing that's happening every single day to poor white Americans. And the truth is 2020 and 2042, you have to win less and less of those poor white Americans and those educated white Americans to the side because you'll have the numbers on the other side to some extent. And that's what they're afraid of. So they're trying to do everything in their power to stop that moment from happening.
Right. And they're terrified now. I mean, that's why they're going to literally people's houses and stealing their votes. And Kris Kobach is doing voter ID check and all that stuff. I mean, they're already doing everything they can to manipulate that system to as much as possible.
I mean, overturning the Voter Rights Act was like amongst the most absurd things that they've ever tried to pass, you know, in this country. And they tried to do it on the premise of equal protection. So basically it's about reverse racism, right?
Right.
It's an absolute absurdity, and it should be absurdity to anybody who pays attention to it. But again, if you're in a cult, you know, and your cult leader tells you the doomsday is coming, and then it doesn't come on the day they predicted, you're still in it. You don't leave it. And that's basically what white supremacy has become, always been. And that's the way they sort of keep the people, you know, keep it in, because it gives people a sense of psychological comfort that they're on the right side of things, that they have a grasp of truth. You know, people always talk about, if you ever listen to any interview with people who voted for Trump and who really love Trump, and the first thing they always say is he tells it like it is. And as far as I can tell, they don't mean, oh, he tells it like it is in terms of, you know, what the tax code should look like. They mean he tells it like it is because he's willing to say these brown people are fucking up our shit. That's the thing that they're talking about. So if you listen to like, that's so, and the reason they think that's the truth is because there's been this movement of talk radio that turned into Fox News that has already been saying that for decades, right? It's not, there's been an entire attempt to frame a worldview around this, and it's been effective. So when then you have a major politician just articulate the same things that Rush Limbaugh articulates, it sounds like the truth to people. Mm-hmm. And those and Rush Limbaugh talks about 2042. Talk radio talks about 2042, the date, the moment, the demographic shift. And now it's all the way up to Tucker Carlson, like you said, who has the biggest platform in sort of the news media in the world, basically.
Yeah. And I think one of the best things we can do also with the Trump presidency is to show, like you said, the diminishing returns of white supremacy actually to poor and, you know, working class white people, and just say, look, like, this is the reality. This is what you're getting with Trump. This is what you're getting with Bannonism. You know, they're coming for your entitlements and food stamps and, you know, Medicare and Medicaid just as well. And, you know, if you continue to, you know, hit yourself to this horse, I mean, you're going to get screwed as well and, you know, pull your head out of your ass.
Yeah, we've all had many, you know, holiday dinners and stuff with our families on this. I mean, I think a lot of people listening probably have too. And it's, I think I think that's where this notion of it being like a cult or the identity where it becomes almost impossible. It becomes very difficult to argue. You know what I mean? And I think it's complicated, right? I mean, it's complicated because, I mean, clearly, you know, like a lot of our family members are not benefiting. You know what I mean? They're still, you know, truck drivers and trash collectors, et cetera. You know what I mean? And I'm sitting here at a dinner with them and the dude's like going off on all this shit. And I'm just like, dude, like you're so fucked. You know what I mean? Like your brain is so fucked. Like right. We're sitting here in like a fucking trailer park right now, dude. Like what the fuck are you talking about? You know what I mean? And so it's like, you know, it's complicated. And I think the kind of analogy of like, you know, or not an analogy, but it being a cult and it really be people bought in like heart and soul to kind of white supremacy in different terms. I mean, is the serious problem? You know what I mean? And it makes it very difficult to combat when it's not really based on actual information or facts or right. historical data or, I mean, you know, or science or, you know, or any of these things. It's complicated.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I mean, when science and all these other things are out of the room, it becomes, it's, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's difficult to.
Or even something with the shutdown. It's like, yeah, please build the wall. Like, take all the, you know, like, you know, take all these like basic things away. Or you know, we don't need money for fire relief victims. You know, build the wall. You know.
Yeah, no. Which is I think though, even more so. I mean, when I reflect on like real change and stuff, I mean, it's not going to be in arguments necessarily. Do you know what I mean? It's about reframing. It's about creating different cultures. It's about, you know, exposing how ridiculous and how uncool that shit is. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, totally. Well, this is kind of a change of gears, but, you know, we brought up veganism and straight edge and they've been long connected to Race Trader. I mean, I don't know where everybody's at with that, but, I know, Andrew, at least on your Twitter account, there's a picture of you lifting weights and stuff. And, you know, just everything that's going on in the country right now, we've got, you know, everything from the rise of opioids to people dealing with, you know, massive rates of obesity, disease and stuff like that. Also, you have groups on the far right and white nationalists like the Wolves of Vinland that really try to kind of recuperate elements of straight edge or, you know, weightlifting and all this stuff, to kind of make their own movements like culturally viable. And I'm curious, you know, with all this stuff going on, do you think that will bring more people towards these kind of like lifestyle choices like veganism or straight edge? And do you think these things kind of need to be repackaged in order for people to gain more interest, or are they basically fine as they are right now?
Yeah, I've definitely noticed like the Wolves of Vinland and stuff kind of co-opting a lot of that stuff. And I think people within, you know, groups like that and that group specifically are like, you know, old Courage Crew dudes or who are kind of right reactionaries the whole time anyway, and just wanted another like weird tribe to belong to. And that's pretty scary, I think. You know, that's been the alt-right's tactic to kind of co-opt things that are. I was listening to a podcast the other day talking about Mike Rowe and like how he tries to pick off like Home Depot Democrats. And it's like that they're trying to pick off like, you know, kind of working class punk hardcore white kids who, you know, are still confused and figuring things out. As for like straight edge and stuff, I think, I mean, where I'm at with it is, you know, I'm still vegan straight edge and I have been for a long time and it's pretty personal and I don't care what anyone else does. I think it's pretty important to be there for anyone who's struggling, you know, anyone that you personally know who's struggling with like that stuff. To be there to give a helping hand because it is such a huge problem right now. And I've listened to, you know, all the past episodes you've done recently about it. And it's a really scary, crazy thing.
Yeah, I think the couple things, like one in terms of this like attachment between like veganism and like, you know, you talked about the Wolves of Vinland and Operation Werewolf, all that stuff, is there's this vision of the man, particularly like the sort of the white European man, of being the master of his dominion and the sort of master of nature, but in a way that they're in tune with it. So if you're this ultra vegan environmentalist, you're not really thinking about, you know, and you want to show your masculinity, like the sort of alt-right recruitment tactics like totally work for you, because there's this like close relationship between like being ultra masculine and being like back to nature. And, you know, you can, like they said, like the Home Depot Democrat, it's not even the Home Depot Democrat. It's like the law. It's like the guy, you know, who lives in the woods off the land, you know, radical. And that's what the alt-right is. So, and we actually saw that all the way back to the 90s. So we were, you know, like we were influenced by Earth Crisis and we were sort of in that vegan straight edge scene. But we were always sort of like, you know, these people who like to talk about animals, like they have really negative feelings towards people in a way that can easily translate into kind of racist, xenophobic stuff. And even like if you look at the history of the environmental movement in the U.S., there's tons of people that have come out of the environmental movement from like racist perspectives and or have gone into the, you know, the things that became the intellectual seeds of the alt-right. So this stuff is like always coexisted. So if you don't have a holistic analysis, you know, human earth and animal liberation as one project, you're gonna miss the boat. And it's the same thing as if you don't have an environmental analysis, you're not gonna identify all the manifestations of white power, because environmental racism is at the core of white power. You know, we saw it with Standing Rock, but it's so much deeper than that. You know, where chemicals get dumped, you know, even the lack of interest in addressing climate change is partly because climate change is mostly going to impact people at the equator when they're, you know, the farmlands dry up and it's going to lead to civil wars or is leading to civil wars and these sorts of things. Well, who lives at the equator? It's brown and black people. So, you know, that's also what ends up, you know, affecting people's analysis. And then in terms of like your actual question about like sort of lifestyleism, I think that you see a lot of sort of movement towards lifestyleism now in politics, and that's really good. But for us, I think it's fair to say that we live these lifestyles, and not all of us are vegan straight edge anymore, but all of us have some aspect of that still. We live these lifestyles because these are what we think are the best representations of our ideals. Like, we all live under capitalism. Capitalism stole your virginity. There is no such thing as veganism under capitalism. There isn't. Like, everything you do is going to exploit something, whether it be animal or human animal. And, you know, we're just doing our best. We're all just kind of picking where we are on the spectrum that, okay, this is what I can handle. I can handle being vegan straight edge. I can handle being vegan, but I need a beer every once in a while, like whatever. And for us, we don't think that that's the revolution, because you could do those things and not contribute to social change at all. And, you know, now veganism is being fully embraced by corporate America. Mm-hmm. And what does it mean at that point when it just becomes another consumer product? But we think being those things shows. Sorry, I'm very long-winded. But we think being those things is like kind of like a guidepost. It kind of shows people like, this is what society can look like. We're doing it at an individual level, but let's figure out how to do it at a societal level. And we're trying to exemplify that in our own lives for ourselves and for our community. And I think that that's impactful.
The one other thing I want to just add to your question is like issue of like obesity and stuff. And I think that, like, you know, for any health indicator there is, I mean, socioeconomic status is like the number one predictor of that, right?
And so, of course, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, if you even just look at zoning laws in cities like Chicago, you know, there's been a big movement, and a lot of people that I kind of connect with and work with about doing, kind of bringing green groceries to neighborhoods that only have like gas stations. You know what I mean? And so I think like, and I think there's been really cool stuff doing kind of the decolonization of veganism in Chicago, which is really cool. You know what I mean? And kind of taking it, outside of like Whole Foods and, you know, like fancy restaurants downtown and, or on the north side, and really kind of connecting it to community work. And so I think we're all like super into all of that and think it's like super rad.
Well, that's what I was kind of getting at, is that do you see these type of things that obviously you all have decades of involvement with as kind of like, I hate to use the word repackaged, but kind of like come back to the fore, like as a vehicle of kind of like this like community and also personal self-defense, you know, being like, you know, like I drive Lyft for 12 hours a day and all I can eat is Taco Bell. And, you know, I get home and, you know, I just want to drink a beer and then go to sleep, and I have to get up and go to work the next morning. And like, you know, that's what's forced upon me. And then I, you know, I'm screwed, you know, like physically or something like that. So I don't know. I was curious.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, I think like someone's like health, right? Their state of well-being, both mental and physical, is like, from our perspective, like, you know, obviously a very like basic human right that this country and many, you know, have failed miserably at, you know. And I think for all of us, tending to those both physical and mental, you know, health issues and the issue of access, right? You know what I mean? And the type of infrastructure that's required to really support the entire community of this country, you know what I mean? I think has really eroded and been privatized, and, you know, starting with like the Nixon administration when they kind of shut down all the mental health community, mental health centers. And, you know, now like the number one provider of mental health services in the U.S. is like the prison system. You know what I mean? And so it's just like, it's right. All that. I think health is very much connected, to, the things that we're concerned about. And that's ultimately what it's about. I mean, I think for us, I mean, it's not some like, obscure thing. I mean, I think most families, you know, most people, however they define family or whatever, I mean, just want to, you know, be cool and feel all right with themselves and their engagement in the world and not be too stressed out and have the support systems in place. So when people are feeling some sort of way, that they have other alternatives than just like, you know, self-medication, be that with, you know, drugs, TV, record collecting, whatever, you know, whatever it is, you know, but actually have a society that has the infrastructure in place to support its citizens and its, you know, whatever family arrangements people have. And I think that's ultimately what we're concerned about. Not, you know, I work in public health, in case you couldn't tell. I mean, you know what I mean? Like that.
And definitely a big shout out to the Haymaker Gym in Chicago that's creating a radical, autonomous, anti-fascist space for people to go work out in. I think that's great to see a proliferation of those spaces come into existence in the U.S. But just moving forward, it seems like there's more and more extreme music festivals that are being organized. And I was just curious, would you encourage people listening to this, if they're into extreme music, whether it's punk or metal or grind or whatever, to organize events like Black Flags Over Brooklyn?
I mean, we're already talking to the promoters of Black Flags Over Brooklyn, Kim Kelly and her comrades. We're already talking to them about replicating it in Chicago. So hopefully something like that happens. I hate to put you on the spot, Kim, but yeah. I mean, we definitely think so. I mean, the whole country is so festival about, I mean, the whole world. I mean, there's so many festivals everywhere. All the time. It's kind of insane keeping up with it, big and small. And it becomes a little silly to us sometimes on a certain level, because it's just, what's the difference between one or another based on, you know, other than like maybe some focus on some genres. And, you know, there are all these extreme music and extreme metal genres. Like, you know, you have the Terror Fest series, which is around all different places in the country. And you have New England Hardcore Metal Fest, and you have a bunch of these sorts of things. But if you can sort of, if you are paying attention to what's going on and you want to, and you're one of these fest promoters, you can really draw a line in the sand. And you could say, our fest is an anti-fascist fest. And by doing that, you see that you kind of force bands to take a position, because bands that are fence walkers can't exactly play something like that, right? And I think that's what's kind of cool about it. Not that you're forcing people to, you know, not that everything is so black and white, but we think definitely fascism is pretty black and white. And, you know, you're either with it or you're supportive of it through your passive and apathetic behavior, or you're trying to at least stand against it. So we hope to see more of those fests. I mean, why do we want just like another fest with the same, you know, 30 bands playing the same riffs? Like, let's try to lend more meaning to them.
And I think also what was really great about this past fest is they had kind of the marketplace downstairs. There was a lot of booksellers and different companies and, you know, that were kind of sharing information and different political groups. And I mean, I think it's been a while since I've been in a show where that was happening. And I think it was cool. I mean, it almost became like a joke in the 90s. Do you know what I mean? And I think that was unfortunate, but seeing it again and just like, you know, I unfortunately was broke, but there was a lot of books. I'm like, oh, I'm writing this down because I'm going to buy that later. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, there was just a lot of good stuff there and a lot of cool tables about political prisoners. And so there was a lot of good stuff happening at the fest at the same time. And I haven't seen something like that at a music fest in a very, very long time. So it was really cool.
Right. There are even like Kurdish anarchist solidarity groups, like,
yeah, very specific stuff.
With actually Kurdish anarchists there to talk to. So like, that was amazing. I mean, that was amazing. We grew up in the 90s and there were workshops and things like that at festivals, right? And that might be laughable now, but I went to those workshops and some of, you know, they were part of my formative years of radical political education, and they became cartoonish and parts of call-out culture became cartoonish. And, you know, some of the elders in the scene can sort of, you know, warn against the elements of that stuff that can be destructive. But I think at the same time, if you really think the punk and hardcore and metal are about creating sort of alternative lifestyles, well, a lifestyle has to be all encompassing. It's political, it's diet, it's music, it's art, it's commerce. And if you really want to do it, then you should do it. And you should really think about all the different elements that make up a person's life and see if you could, you know, cater to it in some ways at a festival. And that's what Black Flags did. And that's what was pretty amazing about it.
So just speaking for the band, what's next up for you all? Tours, any big shows coming up? Are there any plans to release any more music, videos maybe?
Yes, we are playing in May. We're going to be playing a bunch of shows. And they should be announced, or they've been announced, and maybe some more will be announced, who knows. And then we'll be playing throughout the year as much as we can. I mean, we are a band that only plays about 10 shows a year, so that's not a lot. But we'll try to do as much as possible, and we're already started recording our next release, and we hope to be putting out music, if not in 2019, really early next year. So we're trying to stay as active as possible for really being a very, very part-time band. I mean, Andy, gotcha. Andy's like literally in four bands at every single, I think, level of the music industry, from the top to the middle to the bottom. We're the bottom. So he's very, very active. He's very, very active in this sort of space, but the rest of us have a whole bunch of other personal lives and jobs and stuff going on too. But we love this band, and we love the opportunities it gives us to connect with people and to create music that's meaningful to us and hopefully, you know, to some other people. And we're going to try to do as much as possible.
Well, just in closing, I just wanted to ask, are there any bands that you're listening to, anything you're reading, anything that's inspiring you, either art-wise or media-wise, just anything that you kind of want to give a shout-out to or that might inspire somebody else if they haven't heard of it before?
Well, we just got off playing a show with Don Raid, and we love that. We love that band. Like,
yeah.
That was
Neck Fear Death Camp.
Yeah, we love Neck Fear. You know, I don't know. We like a lot of stuff. We actually did a best of 2018, and we included books and movies and podcasts. This podcast didn't make it, but I'm pretty sure it's going to make the 2019 list.
Oh, we can hope. See what we have to do. We have to have you on it first.
It was a massive oversight, actually, on our part, and we're going to self-flagellate for it.
I think there's a lot of stuff. I mean, there's a Chicago band, La Armada, that we like love a lot, and we're hoping to play a bunch with them. And I think in terms of like, we did put a list together. Maybe we can send you the link. But I mean, I think there's a lot of exciting stuff going on. There's a lot of cool bands that we've like, we're friends with and known for a long time, and everyone's like being super active and I think pushing the envelope in terms of, you know, engaging in these ideas a little bit more than maybe people were a couple of years ago. And so I think it's like it's cool. And I think we're inspired by a lot of stuff. We're also inspired by like, you know, a lot of old things too. Like me, Indigo Girls, Swampophilia. I've been rocking that like a lot the last couple of weeks. I think that's a record that people need to, revisit as often as possible.
And I think like there's been a lot written about how last year was the year for black film, but I think we really noticed it because when we were all talking about, you know, our favorite movies of last year, like a lot of those, you know, a lot of the films sort of came from Sorry to Bother You to even, you know, Black Panther, it, all that stuff really impacted us and inspired us and allowed us to remember that art is so much powerful when there's more voices in it, and particularly voices that have, you know, a lot to sort of communicate that's otherwise sort of like pushed out of communication, pushed out of mainstream communication. So there's a lot going on that we really love.
I want to shout out my friend Kevin Tucker. He just put out a new book, The Call of Personality. He runs Black and Green Review and does Wild Resistance, the zine with Zerzan, who you just interviewed a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kevin is always on the cusp of publishing about 10 books.
Yeah. He's been working on a million books for as long as I've known him, which is about 10, 12 years.
Yeah. And they have a podcast now too, so definitely check that out.
Yeah, Black and Green Review podcast is really good.
And we really thank you all for coming on the program. We encourage people to check out Race Trader, check out their albums. They have some great videos up on YouTube. Check out their Bandcamp, check out their music, and thanks for coming on.
And yeah, Facebook is probably the best source for info on the band, but yeah, we got everything. Twitter, we're a little lax on, but we got everything else. Instagram, Facebook, Bandcamp.
Cool.
So check us out. And we really want to thank you. I didn't tell you this before, but when you reached out, I was so stoked because our record label has a publicist, and I was going to ask our publicist how we could get on this podcast. I was going to be like, can you get us on It's Going Down? That seems like somewhere where we could fit in and say something. So we're super stoked to be part of this. And Andy never really does interviews, and he insisted that we set this up so he could do it.
I love the podcast, so thank you.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.